Policy Committee, welcome. Today we're going to start with a House Concurrent Resolution 7, and we will open the hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 7. Senator Von Amici, Gary Conklin, did you? Yes, Gary Conklin, Peggy Lynch. Senator Von Amici, would you like to get started?
Yes, thank you, Senator Morissette. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Von Amici, State Senator for District 17, and I'm here today to testify about Mary Alice Ford and in support of House Concurrent Resolution 7. I do that with some sadness because we feel loss from her passing. The resolution talks about her accomplishments when she served in the Oregon legislature. She served 8 sessions in the House starting in 1981 and had a reputation. She really distinguished herself as a leader on issues regarding human services, seniors, and her community. I've lived in Washington County for a couple of decades now, and so I'd heard of Mary Alice and knew about her reputation in the legislature and especially working across the aisle. And when I first ran for the House in 2006, during my first campaign for the House of Representatives, I got to know Mary Alice. And I was especially thrilled that she was so supportive of me, a Democrat, when she was a Republican. That said a lot about her openness, and she gave me so much encouragement. And right after I got to know her was when she had her first stroke. And I want to tell you a little story about who Mary Alice was. I went to see her in the convalescent center after her first stroke, and I got there to visit her, and she was sitting around a table having lunch with several of the residents, and she was talking about politics, and she was so engaged in this conversation and teaching them about her community and talking about issues of concern, and it just sort of, to me, was a statement about who she was and how involved she was in her community. Mary Alice was also, at one point in time, the chair of the Washington County Public Affairs Forum. She kept up her community involvement after she left the legislature. She was very, very involved in her community, and I got to know a couple of her children. John lives in California, but her son Tom and her daughter Sherilyn, I got to know. I wish I would have gotten to talk with Mary Alice more about her family, because at her memorial service, I had a long conversation with her daughter Sherilyn and realized that her daughter and my daughter, despite a couple of decades of difference in age, were actually working together in some theater productions in the community. So it sort of showed me that I didn't get to know her well enough to talk about family, but we spent a lot of time talking about her community and all that she did in the legislature, and she continued to do supporting her community and human services. I just wanted to show you from her memorial service. This is Mary Alice. If you didn't know her, she was a remarkable woman. I believe that her contributions in the legislature and her community are well recognized by this House Concurrent Resolution, and I encourage you to send it to the floor with a do adopt recommendation so we can acknowledge this remarkable woman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Peggy Lynch. I'm a former resident of Washington County, currently live in Benton County. I hope that you had a chance to see that memorial service picture. Mary Alice had a great smile. Mary Alice was my representative during part of the time that I lived in Washington County. She was a bipartisan representative. She was, don't get me wrong, she had the best elephant collection you have ever seen. On the other hand, she stood for her principles and stands on issues for all of Oregon. So it didn't matter what the party was, it was the issue and what was the best thing for Oregonians. One of the things that I remember Mary Alice for is her work on adult foster care. So if you have a foster care home in your neighborhood, say thank you to Mary Alice, because it allows your neighbors, people who might have some health issues and need some additional care, to live in their neighborhood with their friends and neighbors. So So one of the things, that, one of the reasons that I come is that if each of you can find one thing that you can point to when you leave the legislature and say, I did this for Oregon, I hope that you can do that, as all of us can do for Mary Alice. Amongst the things that I knew her for was that she was in my neighborhood, and we had comprehensive plans way back in the 70s and 80s that we worked on. She was a part of what was called CPO number 3, West Slope, Raleigh Hills, Garden Home area. And by the way, you honored Governor Attia yesterday, and he was a part of that group as well. As a result, and we honor our people who are involved in their neighborhoods. And one of the certificates that we have given people over the years related to that, the sentence works very well for Mary Alice. As a result of his or her efforts, the neighborhood is a better place for our families. For Mary Alice, as a result of her efforts, Oregon is a better place for our families. So I encourage you to adopt this resolution. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling. I also was a constituent for Representative Ford when she served in the legislature, and by virtue of my profession, I also had a professional relationship with her as a lobbyist, trying to convince her to vote for my bills. In addition to the accomplishments that you've heard, I want to just describe two traits that I detected in her that I admire and I still admire in legislators. One is you never, ever had to wonder where Mary Alice Ford stood. She was plain-spoken. In the tradition of Harry S. Truman, she used English in a way that it was in its complete form. there didn't seem to be any words, whether they were in the Oxford English Dictionary or not, that weren't satisfactory to completely explain where she was at. Candid would be an understatement, and I think all of us can aspire to that. Second of all, as has been indicated, while she was a partisan and proud to be a Republican, she was prouder to always advocate for things that made sense. And in fact, I recall the test. Many of you all have tests. You ask us questions when we bring bills to you. The one that she brought invariably was, does it make sense? Show me how it makes sense. Does it work? And I think that's a pretty good test. I still, in my own world, before I ever show up at your doors, try to ask my clients that question, because I think the Mary Alice Ford question is actually a doggone good question that represents, at the end, good policy, if you can say and prove how something makes sense. And the final note that I would make is that in my prior life, I did a community access TV show. For whatever reason, people by the tens watched this show. One of the most interesting segments was when we did election profiles. Most of them are pretty dry things. I'm sure some of you participate in these events and know what I mean. They were never dry when Mary Alice Ford appeared. In fact, when she was challenged by Eileen Q-Tub in a particular race, it was the liveliest show, and actually we got us all the way up, I think, to 125 viewers TV. But in any case, the point is she never shied away from controversy, and it was refreshing. And I, again, encourage you to support this resolution. Thank you.
And Gary, you can answer this question because it was commented that she had the largest elephant collection. Was hers bigger than Bill Markham's?
Mr. Chair, I don't know, but it was pretty large.
Because okay. I know Bill had a rather extensive one.
Yes, so. He did too. Yes. Hers was, at least for me, I saw more of hers than I saw Bill.
Okay. So. He had mostly little tiny ones too, I think.
So. Hers weren't.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. Close a public hearing on HCR7 and open a work session on HCR7. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves HCR7 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator Telfer.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Chair
Marshman. Excused. HCR7 having received the constitutional majority is passed, and Senator Bonamici will carry. Okay, and I'll close the work session on HCR7. Okay. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3273. Jennifer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 3273A allows Department of Human Services to contract with local providers of victim services for the location of staff members at DHS offices for the purpose of fostering a closer working relationship between child welfare and victim service providers. It provides a model for staff to provide case reviews, coordination, and consultation, and make referrals to domestic violence services when child welfare cases are closed after an initial assessment.
Somebody from Representative Tomei's office that I know some of us here that.
Commission Chair, I believe that
Senator
Tomei's
committee
witness testimony, but weren't able to hear it.
Okay. Let's make it two panels. We'll have Sybil and Reagan Gray. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm here with the Oregon Law Center today to provide support for Senate Bill 3273A. I would also offer the support of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, of which we are a member. This bill is a priority of ours because, for the very simple reason that domestic violence is a public health and safety crisis in our state, and the problem when it occurs in families is resulting in a very large percentage of cases being referred to the child welfare system. And so the bill provides a model by which a best practice may be implemented to better address those cases where there is an overlap of domestic violence and child welfare. We know that families struggling because of domestic violence require an extremely intense amount of services to try to help resolve that issue and establish safety for the family. And when that is the underlying reason for a case to be referred to child welfare, the only way that that child can be returned safely to home is to make sure that the domestic violence crisis is resolved. And so the model that's proposed by the bill would allow the Department of Human Services to contract with domestic violence specialists, advocates in the community working at domestic violence service programs who could be on site at the offices in order to provide immediate crisis and safety planning assistance to adult parents who are victims of domestic violence. And what we understand from our experiences is that the child welfare caseworkers who are doing just a terrific job and struggling under a great caseload, their primary focus must be to really address the needs of the child and to see that case through its process. They are not in a position in which they can immediately go with an adult victim to the hospital, for example, for services after an assault. They're not in a position to be able to drive that parent to the courthouse to help them get a restraining order or to help them get into the emergency housing and to provide that safety counseling as well as just psychological counseling and support that's necessary for the victim to be able to move forward and take the steps that that are necessary to establish safety. And so the establishment of a working relationship between those two methods of service delivery, domestic violence advocacy for victims of domestic violence and child welfare advocacy, advocacy for children in child welfare cases, the merging of those service provisions is something that's been nationally identified as a best practice. The National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges is situated in Reno. They do and have for a long time provided a lot of resources to judicial systems, child welfare systems, family court systems to try to say how can we, you know, look at the family crises that, that are going on in our nation and come up with best practices to resolve those. And this is one of their best practices that they've identified. There have been pilot projects in a number of different states. And Oregon itself has actually had significant experience with pilot projects here through the auspices of a couple of different federal grants. So we've tried this in Oregon very successfully in both urban and rural communities. Unfortunately, those grants have all expired with the exception of one that is currently running right now in the Gresham office. One in a child welfare office in Gresham, and there are two folks here who will be testifying afterwards who can talk about the specific experiences that they've seen in that office, the specific successes. But when we have studied the pilot projects in the past, the Department of Human Services has found, after interviewing families and interviewing caseworkers, child welfare caseworkers, as well as domestic violence advocates, that everyone universally was supportive of that model. Both the domestic violence advocates felt that they learned a lot more about how the child welfare system works and the impact of and how they can help parents sort of navigate through that system and best cooperate with safety plans. They also interviewed child welfare caseworkers who I think found that they learned a lot about domestic violence and about the barriers that many parents face in trying to move forward and get safe. And so it became sort of clear to everybody how there is much common ground in and helping families achieve safety for the ultimate benefit of children. They also found that caseworkers were more quickly able, if they had a domestic violence advocate on site, to immediately connect that person with the parent who was struggling. They were more quickly able to achieve safety for that adult parent, meaning they were more quickly able to return a child home to a safe situation, and they were also less likely to have to remove that child in the first place. So just for an example, if a parent comes in and is referred because of domestic violence that is causing a safety threat to the child, if the child welfare worker is able to say, here's an advocate who can help you right now, go to the courthouse and help you get into safe shelter, that if that gets accomplished, that child may not need to leave the home and the caring parent because there may be no further threat may be resolved. If, on the other hand, a caseworker is unable to do that because of the demands of her job or his or her job and is in the position in which she is handing a phone number to a parent to say, you know, please call this number and if you can get across town and if you can get through, you know, you can find this service, that's just a whole different situation, and that's an additional barrier to parents seeking services. I don't mean to say that the domestic violence advocacy services in communities are not doing a terrific job. They are, but they are simply unable to be as widely available as we'd like. So ultimately, we would love to have funding so that the Department of Human Services could have specific resources devoted to hiring and contracting for these services. The bill was initially written that way. Of course, given the current financial situation that we're in as a state, that's not feasible. The bill, as in front of you today, does not have a fiscal impact. It is specifically providing permission to the department to do contracting with local agencies to the extent that we can together come up with funds down the line, either through grants or other community organizations. And then if that funding does become available, the statute or the proposed bill sets out the model by which those services should be provided and indicates that advocates will be available on site, that they will coordinate with caseworkers around case planning, they'll provide emergency services to victims, and they will also coordinate with the drug and alcohol specialists that are currently, as a result of legislation that was passed by this body in 2007, working in the Department of Human Services organizations. And so I guess to sum up, I would say that and just as further background, we know that, unfortunately, in the state of Oregon, one-third of the referrals to child welfare, founded referrals, are as a result of or connected to domestic violence in the home. So this is a major issue in our state. We also know that statistics show that those cases tend to be more concerning, have higher levels of abuse and injury, and potentially levels of lethality. We know that in Oregon there are between 18 and 27 people killed per year in as a result of domestic violence. So this is an issue that, if unaddressed and if left to escalate, can result in the ultimate horror. And so to the extent that we can provide services and facilitate the use of services that will alleviate that and prevent that, we are very appreciative and believe that that's an important public policy step for the state to make. The only other pieces that I would add are that the governor, as a result of a services review that came out in 2008, convened a work group, the Child Safety Work Group, which was full of a number of experts from various different perspectives around the state, to come together to say, how can we do a better job in avoiding the need for foster care and reducing the time that children spend in foster care? And they came forward with a number of recommendations, and funding for this proposal was one of their recommendations. They had a number of others, but it is something that has been identified just nationally as well as locally as a best practice. This was something that was that has been supported by the department, and we're very appreciative of all of the efforts that that members of the department have gone to try to facilitate this. It's just been a really great working partnership, and we really appreciate the attention that you've given to this issue. Thanks.
Reagan?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Reagan Gray, and I'm the policy analyst for Children First for Oregon. Children First's mission is to ensure that all children in Oregon thrive, and increasing the availability of domestic violence services at child welfare offices will really help with that. We have 9,800 Oregon kids that are in foster care on a daily basis, and while foster care addresses those immediate safety needs for kids, the experience of foster care can really increase the child's risk of future problems in the areas of education, employment, and mental health. Domestic violence is among the top three causes for a child being in the child welfare system, along with addictions and mental health issues. And by providing the domestic violence services at the child welfare offices, families can address those safety needs and assure that children can return home safely more quickly. If we can address these issues that put families in crisis on the front end, we can really tackle child safety and produce better outcomes and cost savings in the long run. So Children First absolutely supports House Bill 3273, and thank you so much for hearing from us.
Thank you. Our foster care system has been a major concern of mine for a long time, and the ability to coordinate local resources is critical and in the work we're doing in our work groups, what the Commission on Children and Families is doing. I mean, it all comes down to the coordination of local assets to better serve. And so I think this is a good step in that direction. Any questions? Thank you, Brent. Yeah, Senator Berger.
Yes. This is a great idea, but I'm concerned because of the funding part of it that it might not ever happen. And so I think that it says here that the funding is indeterminate because the bill doesn't really specify. That's actually a pretty big change to try to get staff, the contracting with the providers, and then also to get staff in. Was there any discussion in the group's meeting evaluating the pilot programs, which has been over 7 years, it said, about how this might be funded? Was there a nexus to something that already is taking place? Because as far as the Ways and Means process in this particular time, but I hate to see this just kind of go away and never get done. So can DHS absorb it somewhere in their budget? Those are some of my questions.
Thank you. Chair, Senator Virgil, members of the committee, there is not, I don't believe, the ability to absorb the staffing within the department at this stage of the game. The department, we would say, has been really terrifically supportive, and to the extent that they have, we have been able together to identify sources of funds, they have been very supportive of implementing the model. And they have been supportive of this bill in terms of helping us to move through the process. This wasn't, funding for this was not included in the governor's recommended budget, so of course, you know, that's, that is something that would guide the department's advocacy. But it was something that the department submitted in their request to the governor, so we have felt that the agency's been very supportive. In terms of funding, it is indeterminate. There is no requirement, and that was necessary in order to move the bill forward. We do feel like this is an important step in allowing us to move forward with the proposal, and to the extent that funds do become available, either through grants, and you'll hear about a grant that's currently working, this bill will help us implement the program. And then I think, you know, our goal that has been, we've been very clear about, is that we would like in the future to see funding allocated specifically for this service, and we expect to continue to work on that down the line as we move forward into future sessions. So,
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just make a comment, and that is that they've done a number of pilot projects, and it's a shame that something wasn't done before we get into this economic crisis, because basically this probably would have helped the department get a better report card when they did the evaluation. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. Annie Neal and Gwen Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, for giving me an opportunity to come speak with you today. My name is Gwen Thompson. I'm a child protective service worker at a New Market branch. Prior to being at New Market branch, I was at the Gresham branch, which has domestic violence advocates housed in their CPS unit. So I have the unique perspective of being in a CPS unit where we had domestic violence advocates who were available to respond with CPS workers, and then going to a branch where we didn't have any domestic violence advocates available to respond with CPS. The old saying that you never know what you have until it's gone truly applies to this situation. And to illustrate this point, I'd like to tell you about a family that I worked with at the New Market branch, who I did not have domestic violence advocates to respond with. The mother, she was an educated woman. She had a college degree. She came from a middle-class family. She had been in a relationship with the father of her children for 4 years. Initially, the relationship started out to be verbally abusive. It turned physically abusive. She had stopped having regular contact with her family for the last 2 years of the relationship. By the time we had got involved, he was strangling her on a regular basis. To settle a dispute, he brought in a loaded rifle into the home. When I went to respond to the immediate response, the mother presented to me as defensive, afraid, and was generally unresponsive to any safety planning. This is a common occurrence in domestic violence situations. Batterers often tell the victim that they're unfit parents. They threaten them if they leave the relationship that they will take their children or that they'll call CPS. So when I show up, I am the embodiment of that batterer's threats. The mother was unresponsive to safety planning. I filed a petition. She fled. I filed a warrant. The children were found by Portland police. They were homeless. They were without any adequate food. They were without adequate resources. They were placed in protective custody. This was a very traumatic event for the children and for the mother. I feel if I had had a domestic violence advocate to respond with me at that particular situation, that the outcome of this would have been a lot different. A domestic violence advocate would have responded with me at that initial call. The domestic violence advocate would have initiated the mother in some safety planning, would have been available to hook her up with resources in the community, would have been very useful in getting her into a shelter, and would have began safety planning with her around her family members. Because the domestic violent advocate is not a child protective service worker, their ability to engage that mother in safety planning is much different than my ability to engage that parent. No matter how fair I am, empathetic I may be, or understand the dynamics of domestic violence, I'm still a child protective service worker, and my ultimate focus in that interaction is child safety. And there's always the threat of removal whenever you're talking to CPS. And whether it's said or not, the parent still feels it. I feel that if the domestic violence advocate had been able to interact with that mother in safety planning, the identified safety threat of the batterer would have been greatly reduced. I would have never filed a petition. The mother would have never fled, and the children would have never entered foster care. This is just one example of many cases I feel that I could tell you about to illustrate the importance of domestic violence advocates and CPS consulting with one another, coordinating with one another, and responding with one another. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Ms. Neal.
Good morning. My name is Annie Neal. I work for Multnomah County as the project coordinator for one of the pilot projects. It's federally funded through the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to evaluate child outcomes for projects like ours that provide specific interventions for kids exposed to violence. So our project is funded for another just under a year and a half, and we've had great success working with Child Protective Services, obviously. I thought I would tell you a little bit about domestic violence services and how this also benefits domestic violence services, not just child welfare services. In Multnomah County, we have 4 shelters with 100 beds for the entire community and 8 non-residential victim service programs, and they get well over 40,000 calls per year and have to tell many people, no, I can't help you right now. So while we've had this great success, agencies are already at capacity and they don't have the resources to devote to placing staff at the child welfare office. It's also a very specialized system. It takes a lot to learn what the child welfare office does and what their responsibilities are and to coordinate your services. So it's not just showing up and dropping in when you're available and have some free time. You have to really learn that system so you can work well with the child welfare program. Domestic violence victims, 1 in 7 victims actually try to get help from a domestic violence program. For the child welfare office, though, it seems like from our experience, most of the people that we reach through that program haven't asked for help. They don't know where to go. They don't know what's available. So we're reaching people who have severe domestic violence and usually other issues that are affecting their families, but don't really know what they can do. So that's, I think, really important for us to realize that we're missing a lot of people that need this help. So having access through the child welfare office gives us the ability to help people in a major crisis. As Gwen said, when families get involved with child welfare, that's usually a point of crisis and they're juggling multiple demands and they're very afraid that their kids are going to be removed from them and they'll never see them again, as many batterers do threaten that specific scenario. So having an advocate that is right there on site who can meet with them or who can go with the worker. Just in the past week, one of the advocates went to the hospital to interview a mom and offer her services for the domestic violence issues. They wouldn't have that access. They wouldn't have that ability to understand what's being offered to them. They're often just given a phone number and told, call for domestic violence help, and nobody really knows what they're asking for. They don't know how to ask, and so having people on site really meets their needs in a different way. They can also offer really specific services that are targeted at the child welfare concerns. The domestic violence programs often provide support groups that specifically address the impact of domestic violence on children and the impact of domestic violence on parenting, and that really helps address the specific concerns that domestic violence creates, the safety concerns that domestic violence creates for kids. So there's a lot of benefits to having people there on site. And the final thing that they've been really good at being able to offer is ongoing support. When child welfare can close the case and make sure there's ongoing support for the family, they reduce the chance of that family coming back into the system. So the domestic violence programs have been able to provide ongoing support even after child welfare has been able to close the case. And for some workers, they've been able to close the case because they feel good about the kinds of supports that are in place and that the safety risk has been mitigated for the kids. So we just really appreciate you taking the time to hear about this project and this service model and your support for these kinds of projects continuing when we can find the money for them.
One of the consequences of abusive relationships is the learned behavior that the children pick up, and then the abuser, usually a male, maybe not always, but usually, are they ever apprehended? Are they ever charged? Are they ever counseled? Are they ever? Do they ever recover from their abusive manner? Is it just a serial kind of thing that goes on? I'm sure a lot of it is.
I will say that one of the things that when domestic violence advocates and child welfare are housed in the same building, what happens is a cross-discipline learning. And I can say that I have used a lot of the things that I have learned from working with the domestic violence advocates and learning about batterers and also learning about the criminal justice system and how to intervene. There are a lot of situations now where my focus is on keeping the victim safe and holding the batterer accountable, and I've learned how to use the district attorney's office and law enforcement, and a lot of that is as a result of having just cross-training that occurs while you're in the mailroom and you're just touching base about a case and consulting with one another.
Have you seen positive results?
Absolutely. I can think of several cases where the kids are with the mother and the batter is no longer a risk because I am working with probation, the district attorney's office, and law enforcement to keep the victim safe.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is there hope for the person who is the abuser, the batterer? I mean, you know, you can restrain that person, you can keep them away from that family, but then, and that's a whole other area, I guess, if you concentrate on changing behavior, I don't know.
Well, I think when you begin to get some education about domestic violence, or at least for my, I begin to interact with batterers different. I think a lot of the time our practice is to say, go get a restraining order, call police if he shows up. And we leave that then on the victim to sort of be responsible for her own safety. I think child welfare, through some education and cross-training, can learn to say to the batterer, well, I'm going to go ahead and sit down and I'm going to meet with you, I'm going to talk to you, I'm going to engage you in treatment too. I want you to get involved. You can be a part of the family if that's what you want, or you can be a part of your children's life. I'm going to need you to go to some treatment. I'm going to need you to provide financial support to the mother. And yours just as responsible or more than the mother in terms of maintaining the in-home safety plan. You're just as responsible if your children come into foster care because you violated the plan, or you're more responsible. And I think beginning to have those conversations with batterers, I've seen a lot of success in terms of the victim's safety and also the batterers getting involved in treatment.
And From my perspective,
yeah.
Working with domestic violence victims, I often see sort of the worst in the offenders who probably are serial offenders, but they aren't all lost causes. They can change. If they don't get any messages that their behavior is inappropriate, they don't get any intervention, any kind of accountability, they don't have any incentive to change. So having child welfare involved, having the police work with victims and respond to high-risk domestic violence cases, having probation that really understands the dynamics of domestic violence and what kinds of interventions are really suited for domestic violence offenders all makes a huge difference, and that's the kind of cross-system learning that we're doing. In fact, we're planning a training. Gwen doesn't know this yet. We're planning a training on working with perpetrators for child protective service workers because they have a really important role in sending the message this behavior doesn't work. This behavior puts your kids at risk. So,
good. Thank you. Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Sybil for inviting me to the Gresham office because I met with the Gresham office and they had the caseworkers there and some families. And this system does work. And as a public health nurse, I referred several, not a lot, but several to domestic violence shelters. And their life is so chaotic as it is, and the fear of losing their children is so great. And it's too bad we can't even, if we can't fund this, if we can't have people like CASA workers, but these cases are so complex, you really need to have specialized training to work with them and know the system. I still wish that if the caseworkers retired, that they would volunteer at the domestic shelters and just continue this program in that way. But I'm a strong advocate of this, and I know that it definitely helps, especially the victim and the mother in that transition and getting out of an abusive relationship.
Senator Berger.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the pilot project question because you're involved now in a pilot project that's going to go on for another year, a year and a half. And then at the end of that, if nothing happens, this frustrates me when you're both so very clearly articulate the success of what you've seen when you're able to interact. And yet, over 7 years, they've had pilot projects and they've all died. Is this because of funding? Is it because the federal government funds the pilot project but has no interest or part funding in what happens after that? Because I think that it's fine, but the purpose of pilot projects is to see if it works. And if it's successful, something is supposed to happen, and nothing has happened. So would you respond to that?
Sure. The pilot project that we have right now is evaluating the child level outcomes and how much impact this service for moms and kids together has on the child's outcomes, health, behavioral outcomes, those sorts of things. The federal government funded a large multi-stage Safe Start Initiative, and that it's part of one of the four stages of the Safe Start Initiative. So they've been evaluating the child level outcomes before they proceed with ongoing funding. And honestly, I don't know what will happen with ongoing funding at the federal level. Local communities that had some of the funding, some of the pilot projects run through the State Department of Human Services, have in some cases pieced together ongoing support through, for example, funding from the Commission on Children and Families and some other small grants, but it's not systematic. So that's the challenge. Even if this project ends, I do think that the relationships and the learning has really improved our ability as a community to respond to these really complex cases. So we don't want it to end, but it still has some benefits, and that I think will continue even after this specific pile of money goes away.
Thank you very much. Stacy, would you like to come up and speak to the pilot?
Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Stacy Ayers. I'm the program manager for the Protective Services Unit for the Department of Human Services. And just Representative Senator Cruz, Senator Berger, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's her and I'm me. Sorry.
I Looking at the name tags, yes, it confused me. Just in response to your question about funding and pilots, I think that clearly there's when the pilots are rolled out, those are things that we try to look at and see, do these work? And if so, can we continue to use them? I think the problem that we run into is nobody can foresee what the financial situation is going to be like in the future. And I think that clearly the economic situation right now is we're in such a place that we can't continue to fund certain projects. I think that there's nobody that would discount. I would certainly not discount. I've been in the field, worked as a child protective services worker, doing protective services investigations, worked in law enforcement, and I know the benefit of having domestic violence advocates in the offices. I get it. It's extremely important. And it's not that this is less of a priority than other forms of child abuse. It's just, sometimes these are, when we're looking at, do we fund this or do we fund that? And incidentally, those aren't the decisions that I make, they are things that, somebody higher than me makes a decision about whether we're going to fund this project or that project. And unfortunately, funding for this type of project, it hasn't been put forward. I think that we're wanting to have the language in this bill as an allow so that it provides the flexibility for the agency and whatever branches to be able to work with the advocates in their local communities. So.
Senator Sanderson.
I'd just like to ask you a question. It might be kind of a simple question, but do you really need a bill to allow somebody to work together?
I haven't heard the Senator Cruz and Senator Berger. I haven't heard the testimony, but I think that one of the things that was put forward in one of the conversations that I had was in response to a question that I received earlier, I think at the first hearing on this bill, and it was similar question to what you had asked. I think that no, you don't necessarily have to have a bill to say that you allow somebody to do something, but I think that having this language in there basically says that if you're going to do it, it kind of gives some outlines of how things should be done.
Okay, I agree.
So,
yeah.
All right. Senator Mona Sanderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the department has gone through a great transformation. You call it transformation. And I can't help but think that this is one issue that would come up when you're dealing with a transformation. And I don't know if Mickey is around or not to talk about that, and or maybe you've been involved with it. To me, when you have transformation, going through this transformation process, that things like the domestic violence and the advocate would prove to be very efficient in dealing with the clients, and I was just wondering if this aspect was taken into consideration when you've done such wonderful, great, major changes within the department.
I don't know specifically, and I apologize, Vice Chair Cruz and Senator Mons Anderson. I don't know specifically that the issue of domestic violence was specifically looked at kind of as the transformation has been occurring. I know that there are many things that there are always discussions that we're having as we're trying to improve our processes. For instance, there were recommended cuts in relation to drug and alcohol programs for the child welfare, the family support teams, and we also know that people are involved in domestic violence relationships, there's often a correlation between domestic violence and drug and alcohol use, and there's higher rates of drug and alcohol use in domestic violence relationships. And I wouldn't begin to tell you that I know specifically what the reasons are for that. I can speculate, but I'm not sure that that's helpful. I think that anytime we're kind of looking at, again, improving our processes, we're always having those discussions. but I guess in answer to your question, I'm not sure that we specifically talked about, you know, any specific type of, you know, risk that was going on in a family, like
just,
drug
just
or alcohol.
Follow up then. I just want to bring that to your attention, and you might talk about that with your supervisors.
Sure.
Is this an issue that you could look at?
Thank you.
Transformation. It may not be. But.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Want to say for the record, we have letters in our bill file from Representative Tomei and Senator Rosenbaum. And if there's nobody else interested in testifying, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3273 and open a work session on House Bill 3273. Representative Senator Mona Sanderson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3273 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Mona Sanderson has moved House Bill 3273 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Telfer.
Thank you. You know, while I see this, I'm kind of torn. I see this as a very valid request, but it's an unfunded mandate at this point. And I just put this extra pressure on the department that is being stretched to the limit right now with all the services. I would like to see this just happen because everybody's found a way to do it, that we haven't had to mandate it to be done, that it just be done, and that you find grants or whatever it is to have it implemented. But to do it statutorily as an unfunded mandate, I'm just really struggling with at this point. Because it's going to bump something else that's perhaps currently being done that isn't mandated.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Mona Sanderson.
I appreciate your comments, but I don't see this as a mandate. It will just allow them to do it if they want to, and they wouldn't do it unless they felt that it was working for the system.
Mr. Vice Chair, well, as I read Section 1, Subsection 2, it says Department of Human Services shall contract.
Are you looking at the original or the A engrossed?
Yeah.
The A engrossed is
May. I don't have
May.
The A engrossed.
Changed.
They changed it to May. It.
Oh, I apologize then, because I don't have the A engrossed.
That would have been an issue.
It would.
Follow up then.
Okay.
Follow up then. I had a committee meeting yesterday where we were questioning this shall being changed to May, and we were told that it means the same thing. So now I'm still a little perplexed.
Well,
it changes.
How long do you want for the history of the debate in this building on shall and may?
I know.
Actually, it comes down to, I think, context of
this
the use of the words. This, mm-hmm. As I read this, this is just permissive. It's not a requirement. What I've learned over time is when you look at the use of shall or may in LC language, you have to look at the words surround it to get the intent. So,
with your permission, thank you, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, Chair Cruz and Senator Telfer. I believe that shall and may get confused or interpreted to mean the same thing more in the context of if it's someone shall not versus someone may not. And those tend to mean very similar things. But if you say someone shall do something as opposed to someone may do something, there are two very different meanings. So I agree that it's the context. And the amendment in the A engrossed bill was specifically to remove the shall because that would have been a mandate. And there wasn't the funding to do that. And so the bill, the A engrossed bill, has the fiscal that is minimal, indeterminate, because there's no burden on the agency. It just provides the authority to do the contracting if funds become available and sets out the model by which that program should be implemented to the extent that funds do become available. So,
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. And I apologize. I didn't have the A engrossed, and with that explanation and with the May, that I'm feeling much more comfortable in passage of this bill.
Senator, I don't think I would have been comfortable with the original bill, or I don't know that any of us would have been. So, it wouldn't have been here. It would have been in Ways and Means with that. So, is there any other discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Martin? Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator
Tolkien. Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morrison.
Excused. House Bill 3273, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed, and we will let Senator Rosenbaum carry it, as it's her bill. And with that, I'll close the work session on 3273. Where are we going next, Jennifer? My choice?
Your choice. Builder's choice.
I'll open a public hearing on 2134. Jennifer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2134A in gross designates lead poisoning as a significant health concern. It creates complementary programs under the Department of Human Services and the Construction Contractors Board for licensing and certification of lead-based paint renovation and lead-based paint activities as defined by statute. Requires DHS to establish standards for best practices related to lead-based paint activities and to develop and approve training programs for certification of service providers. It allows the CCB to establish rules for licensing contractors in lead-based paint activities and requires that licensing requirements include the DHS certification. Allows both departments to suspend or revoke a license or certification and to inspect and assess civil penalties up to $5,000 in their regulatory area. Requires cross-reporting of fines assessed and establishes an account for the CCB fines. Requires both departments use the fines proceeds for lead-based paint activities, including abatement, lead screening, and education based on their areas of regulation and expertise. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement impact was issued.
Okay. Gail Shibling, Craig Smith.
Mr. Vice Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to hear this bill. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health and the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. 2134A does two things. One, it provides the statutory authority, as the committee administrator very accurately stated, for the state of Oregon to apply for primacy from the federal government to implement a new federal regulation over lead-based paint activities that may expose children to a very potent neurotoxin. And two, it does it in a way that really streamlines the required oversight of those who will be subject to the regulation and leverages the expertise and relationships thereby. Regarding that, the first point, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency adopted a regulation that was required under Section 402 of TSCA, the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act, that will soon begin in April 22nd, I believe, of 2010, and will regulate remodeling, repair, and painting that disturbs lead-based paint in either target housing or child-occupied facilities, specifically focused on 0 to 6 years of age. And, of course, both of those terms are defined in the federal rule. The target housing, actually in both cases, it is all pre-1978. 1978 was kind of the second watershed year in terms of the amount of lead that was allowed under the Consumer Product Safety Commission to be contained in residential or non-industrial paint. This really is the most significant change in EPA lead-based paint rules in more than a decade, and we think it is a very positive step forward to protect children from, as I said, a very potent neurotoxin. These kinds of activities, repair, renovation, and painting, otherwise known as the RRP rule by the EPA, really accounts for almost all of the kinds of activities that can expose children to lead-based paint, dust, residue, chips, etc. As with most federal programs, or many federal programs, certainly in the environmental area, Oregon has a choice. Either we implement it ourselves and oversee a program that is at least as stringent as the federal requirement, or the federal government oversees and implements the regulation. So the issue before you is, should Oregon take on implementing and overseeing this program, or should we have the federal government do it? It is a federal requirement. It is it covers the entire country. Without this authority, Oregon firms would be regulated by regional or national environmental protection agency regarding all aspects of the rule, including training, accreditation, certification, technical assistance, and enforcement. We're convinced, not surprisingly, but we think very, very compellingly, that Oregon is a better choice to oversee this new program. First, lead is a very important health concern here in Oregon. Lead-based paint is a leading cause of lead exposure, accounts for 70% of childhood lead poisonings in Oregon. I think you'll hear this morning from some individuals who have some very powerful and tragic experiences in that regard. Moreover, nearly half of all childhood lead poisonings in Oregon are related to home renovation, repair, and painting. Second, though, the bill really focuses or implements this new regulation in a way that leverages the skills, expertise, and relationships of state agencies. Working with the Construction Contractors Board, DHS will accredit all of the training, and will also work directly with those firms and individuals who are not currently subject to regulation by Construction Contractors Board, CCB. Those contractors who are regulated by CCB will be able to go directly to and work as they always do with CCB. So we feel that that really focusing on the expertise of our two agencies allows us to do this in a very strong, efficient, streamlined, but very effective way. Craig Smith with Construction Contractors Board is a very important partner with us in arriving at the A engrossed version of this bill, as is Scott Berry with the Home Builders Association, the Remodelers Association, the Painters Union, the Contractors Association. This really is a consensus agreement, if you will, that you have in the language of the bill before you. I provided just a couple handouts that went along with my testimony. I think first there was a brochure that EPA has made available. It doesn't come out nearly as nice on our black and white printer as it is on the nice color, but this is a bit of the information that is available. It's a trifold brochure, lead safety during renovation, that's focused on contractors. There is also very integral requirement in the new regulation for Renovate Right, which is a brochure that is currently being rolled out and required to be provided before renovation begins. The second thing that I just wanted to share with you, really just as an informational piece, getting down into the meat of the requirements of the regulation itself, is also provided by the US EPA. It's a sample renovation record-keeping checklist, and you notice that EPA identifies that it's effective in April 2010. So again, this is our effort to be in a position to be able to write the rules and begin to put the program in place between July and January, when the bill is slated to go into effect, so that we can be prepared to work with the federal government, certify that we have the authority that's required by the federal law, and implement the bill here in Oregon for Oregonians. I dare say, as my beloved former colleague Mary Alice Ford would say, we think it just makes sense as a proposal for Oregon. So in sum, we really are focused on administering major improvements. It's not the be-all, end-all for lead poisoning prevention, but it's a very positive, powerful step in the right direction, and we can streamline this process, and that's what we intend to do. So appreciate the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions. Suggest that perhaps Mr. Smith may want to voice his support as well.
Thank you, Gail.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. Of course, we play a minor role in this. Today I'm here to answer questions as to how this program might be administered by CCB. We've worked hand in glove with Gail and the folks to help craft the legislation. Most of this was provided by the industry as opposed to the agency. But again, you can imagine that what we'll be doing is, if you choose to make this Oregon law, we will work between now and the first of the year to develop rules, to set out the program, to educate contractors as to what the requirements will be. And it probably makes a lot of sense, I think it does, that contractors will get their certification based upon information prescribed by the department, the training that they can do during their continuing education burden that the contractors board will be invoking, and then come back with that certification. We'll put that certification onto the license. People will be able to see if a contractor is properly certified to do this type of work, and then maintain those records and, of course, do some enforcement as well. So is there any questions that I might answer?
Yes. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the fiscal. And why didn't this go to Ways and Means? Because it's a for the 2009-11, it's other funds. I know it's not general fund, but still, it's an appropriation that's made by Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, thank you for that. I think it is slated to go. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah. Okay.
And I appreciate you raising that. There are new fees associated with this. As I said, the question is, do those fees get paid to folks here in Oregon, or does it get paid to the federal government? This is included in the governor's recommended budget. There is some tweaking that needs to understandably happen in Ways and Means as a result of the changes that went from the bill as introduced to the A engrossed version, because the revenue now will be distributed between the two agencies as opposed to just one. But it is going to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Sure, thank you. And I should have noticed that referral on there, because there's things that not only the dollars, not that this is a bad idea, but things that always confuse me are like DHS will need 1.13 FTE to fund four permanent part-time positions. I don't know what a permanent part-time position is. You know, and 1.13 FTE is $156,000. You know, so there are some questions that need to be asked, and clearly that's not in our purview at this point. So,
okay. Senator Bridger.
Yes, I have two questions. One, will you just be implementing the federal standard, or are you going to have Oregon standard stricter than the federal? And the other one is this just adding more and more regulation and responsibility to business that already has constantly being asked to do more and more and more just to stay in business?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I appreciate the both of the questions. Your first question was whether or not Oregon was going to adopt stricter standards. We have stated on the record that this is to implement the federal regulation and to not enact anything more strict. I did mention that there are folks who see that there are some holes in this, so to to speak, in terms of protection for children. It's my understanding, actually, that Congress is considering changing the federal law. I don't know that is going to happen, but I do understand that those discussions are taking place in Washington. But in terms of our Oregon program, we intend to track the federal law and not enact stricter standards. Regarding your second point, is this more regulation on businesses? Yes, it is. It is, as I said, a federal regulation. And from a public health standpoint, I will share with you that lead poisoning is entirely preventable. It is irreversible. It is lifelong. And we are very concerned from a public health standpoint that people, particularly children, are being unnecessarily exposed to lead poisoning. How that is done has been answered for us, quote unquote, by this federal regulation. And so our effort and our commitment is to implement it in the most efficient way that we possibly can.
Yes, Senator Telford.
It appears to me that it's another one of those unfunded federal mandates. You started your testimony with, is this something Oregon should do or let the federal government do it? And in these economic times, I'm inclined to say let the federal government do it, since they've not funded this mandate. And so what do we lose by letting the federal government do it?
Mr. Chair, this is Senator Telfer. I think that's a very good question, and there are some of what I'm going to say may be philosophical in nature, and some may be very practical. From a very practical standpoint, the Oregon enforcement, the civil penalties, as a committee administrator stated, is $5,000, or the potential for up to $5,000. At the federal level, the civil penalty authority is $32,500 every day for every violation. Whether or not they charge that much, but that's the difference in the ceiling. It's order of magnitude. Also from a very practical level, getting the kind of technical assistance, information, other assistance from the federal government is, I dare say, fairly challenging to try to call a long-distance number or send an email when somebody's on a job site or wanting to do the right thing, which we are convinced the vast majority of folks simply want to know, what is it that I need to do? How do I do this? I've got a question. Can you help me? We deal with that all the time, and I think you may be hearing from our partners at the local public health level that they deal with that all the time as well. We're convinced that in terms of protecting the public's health, that's the kind of responsiveness that is very needed. Perhaps on a more philosophical level, there is an issue of federalism, which is, you know, are we going to take charge of what happens within our state at the state level, or are we going to have the federal government continue to pierce that jurisdictional sovereignty?
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are we going to be hearing from industry at all?
Yes, we will. Okay, I have two comments. First, having had this discussion with Roy Orr, who is the director of the mental hospital, and is very concerned about having to pay the federal government to come in and take over our mental health system at a much higher cost. But we are on the cusp, I guess, of avoiding that. That's the worst case scenario. So, you know, if the feds have to come in and do our job, we're going to have to pay them more than it would cost us to do it. Secondly, one of the concerns that I, well, it wasn't a concern, a question that I had for you. I have several duplexes, and I just got through putting in a new furnace in one of them to the tune of $2,000, which I didn't like, but that is my cost of doing business. I am very happy to have my property management company understand what is involved in this, and they will have their people, whomever they have to come in and do this. So I think that to me is fine. I mean, I can't afford it though. I mean, I'm not making a whole lot of money on my duplexes right now, and but it's a cost of doing business, and it's a safety issue. So I'm okay. I just want to be sure that my property manager gets, and I'm hoping that, you know, you're going to be dealing with the contractors, and I'm hoping, and I mentioned to you, that property managers throughout the state have to understand this too. So they are responsible, ultimately, and I'm ultimately responsible if they mess up. So I want to be sure that all those bases are covered.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that perspective, and I do want to assure folks that, and I think, unfortunately, that the home builders representative, Scott Berry, had to take his daughter
to
school.
Yeah, but we have a couple of really great home builder representatives back there.
That's
John Chandler is going to be up here, too, and I can hardly wait to get him on the hot seat, because I have questions to ask him about other things.
Mr. Chair, since this bill is posted for a possible work session, I would encourage the committee to send this on to Ways and Means so we can get this through. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Okay, somewhere I have a list of people. Craig Warner. Okay. Kate O'Donnell. And then we have two more after that, but we'll go two at a time. Is this our last
one?
Do we have another one?
We have two.
Okay. We're going to have to kind of move this along, too, if we can. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
I want to thank you for allowing me to come and testify in favor of HB 2134.
Okay.
My name is Greg Warner. I work for Multnomah County Health Department. I'm involved in the Healthy Homes Program, the Lead Line Referral Program, and Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. As such, I investigate all children lead poisonings in Multnomah County. I go out and do the tests, do the investigations, determine why the child has been poisoned. What we're talking about here is allowing the state to administer the new EPA rules. And these rules are extremely important, and finally they address remodeling and renovation. This was not in the EPA's previously. Well, this accounts for 95% of the cases of lead paint being disturbed. It also, I can tell you from my investigations, at least 50% of the childhood lead poisonings are due to remodeling. In fact, the first question we ask people when we have a poisoned child, has there been any remodeling that's been done recently in the home? The problem is, if the EPA takes over this program, they're located in Seattle. Economically, we know that the fees that the business will be charged will not be any higher under this bill than the EPA would charge, and probably would be less. And the other thing is, the state is so responsive. Here in Multnomah County, we're in contact with the state almost on a daily basis with the lead poisoning prevention program there. And when we get a phone call from a homeowner that says that my neighbor has somebody working on their house and paint chips are flying all over the neighborhood, I can call the state, and within hours somebody will go out and educate the contractor or the homeowner as to the proper way of doing this. I'd like to give you two quick examples of the problems. We talk about the economics of this. an example was that we had a rental house in Portland where contractors came in, they removed the paint, did a terrible job of it, and we found out about it because we had a poisoned child, a young child. And I did the investigation and found levels, the windowsill near where the child slept was 10 times the lead action level, the federal action level. It was no, I'm surprised the child wasn't poisoned even more heavily than they were. Anyway, it required that the city of Portland come in. They had to tag the house. The house had to be cleaned up before it could be rented again. And what we're talking about here is all kinds of extra money involved. If it had just been done right, there wouldn't have been a poisoned child and there wouldn't have been all this expenses. We also had a daycare center where a contractor came in, should have known better, it was a large painting contractor, did a terrible job. The neighbors complained. We went out and checked it, and it had far too much lead in the yard inside the daycare. It required the company to come back, clean it up, clean up the entire yard. It still wasn't good enough. All I'm saying is all these visits by the government, these cleanups and so forth, are much more expensive than had they just done it right. So I would just like to thank you for allowing me to testify in support of this bill. It will be a great benefit to the health of Oregonians, especially young children. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Martha and members of the committee. Thanks for taking the time to hear our testimony today. My name is Kate O'Donnell, and I'm the program coordinator at the Josiah Hill III Clinic. We're a multicultural grassroots nonprofit organization whose mission is to protect children from environmental hazards and to promote community action for healthy homes. Since 1997, when our founder, the late Josiah Hill III, began our efforts, we've been focusing on addressing lead poisoning in Multnomah County. Our organization provides free blood lead testing screenings and conducts outreach and education to families about ways to reduce exposure to lead hazards in the home. Just to give you some perspective, we provide about 500 to 600 tests every year to Portland area families. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2134. Our staff frequently speaks with people who are concerned that their children have been exposed to lead through remodeling projects. And in recent months, I've personally tested multiple members of a family who have had high levels of lead in their blood due to a remodeling project. Currently in Oregon, as you have heard today, about half of investigated lead poisoning cases are due to lead hazards created by remodeling projects. By adopting the RRP, contractors will be trained in lead-safe work practices, which would include setting up work areas which do not expose residents to lead hazards, minimizing dust, and leaving the area clean. Our organization strongly encourages DHS and CCB to adopt clearance testing as well in the eventual rulemaking. Clearance testing is more stringent than the EPA's white glove test and, in our view, is more productive of children. In adopting the RRP rules, there are benefits to having DHS and CCB oversee and enforce the program rather than EPA, as you've already heard today. Benefits include everything from having a local office, which specifically focuses on Oregon, versus a regional office in Seattle, which covers multiple states, a quicker response time to complaints, as Mr. Warner was saying, and concerns regarding unsafe work practices, and the awareness of local government and community-based organizations, which can further provide assistance and support to family members who have been exposed to lead. So on behalf of the Josiah Hill Clinic, I ask the Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee to pass House Bill 2134, and thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. There is one other area. The house that I live in, we bought in 1966. It's over 100 years old. I did extensive remodeling. I have 8 children. I don't know if any of them got lead poisoning. I have no idea. I did get a building permit, and I did have do wiring and plumbing and had inspections. Nobody ever mentioned that. Now, are you going to be dealing with building permits for the homeowner who decides to remodel their 100-year-old home and scrape off all that old paint and put in new paint and so on? Are homeowners involved in this?
I believe they are not. That is not part of
okay.
This.
Okay, yeah, okay. That's, but that's the one one of the areas that I think, you know, I didn't even think of that at the time. We bought that in 1966, and I was doing remodeling over time, and I have no idea if, I just don't know. Interesting. Thank you. Tamara Rubin?
Perry?
Yeah. Cabot?
Hi.
Hi there.
My name's...
Where's your baby?
Outside with my 12-year-old who's skipping school.
So okay. Okay. Sorry we didn't get to you sooner.
And I have just prepared a short statement that I wrote that I'll read, and I want to tell you a little bit more about my story. I have some responses to some of the comments that you've made and a bunch of things I'll try and get through, but I might not get through it all. My name is Tamara Rubin. My children were poisoned by the work of a painting contractor when we lived in the Irvington neighborhood of Portland, Oregon. He was not fined or punished for poisoning my children and my home and causing my family extreme financial distress. As a result of this, we are now on food stamps and in foreclosure because of the financial impact of this contractor poisoning my children and my home. My story can be found on my website if you want to know all the details and hear it over again. It's mychildrenhaveleadpoisoning.com. I've been working as a nationally on a national level as an advocate, trying to get these laws changed just by sharing our story as much as I can. I support HB 2134A as fundamentally a sound beginning to allowing local regulation, enforcement, and fines in relation to the violations of the new EPA RRP rule for contractors who break the law and poison children, as mine were poisoned. One of the main reasons that I support this is because with our case, our contractor, we asked him, are you certified to safely handle lead paint? He said yes. We went with him as opposed to other contractors we interviewed. He charged $18,000 to repaint our home. Apparently, he was going to use lead-safe work practices. He lied. He wasn't certified. Instead of using lead-safe work practices, he used the most dangerous methods possible. He used open flame torch burning, dry scraping, and pressure washing, and my children were poisoned by inhaling the lead fumes from the open flame torch burning and the resultant dust that settled all over our home. It cost us over $200,000 to clean up the mess caused by the contractor and left my children with permanent learning disabilities and behavioral disorders that I deal with every day. The two children that were most affected are not here. They are right now ages 4 and 6, and they were 8 months and 3 years old at the time they were poisoned. And the main shortcoming in our case, which we tried to sue the contractor, but the laws that are currently there are not enforceable, and so we didn't have a strong case on that level. There was no tool in place to fine him for what he did. He wasn't, he didn't lose his license. He's still out there today poisoning other children and other people's homes, including bringing the dust home to his family and poisoning his family and children. And I want to be clear here on a couple of points. One is contractors are not the bad guy. The bad guy right now is the lack of generational memory and education. And this legislation will help to educate the contractors so that they can do the right thing, and will also help educate the public and administrators and child care providers through all of the programs involved, including testing of children and homes, and bring back the generational memory that we've lost, because most people in their 30s to 50s don't know about lead poisoning, don't think of it as a problem, renovated their own home, don't think of their children as being at risk. Just a couple other things. You know, earlier today you were talking about mental illness. There was a talk about domestic violence, and all of these issues are impacted by lead poisoning. Lead poisoning causes violent behavior. It's a huge problem. It impacts the costs of our healthcare system and costs throughout our educational system, special education. So by taking this on, we are going to defer or negate the need for other costs and other programs. programs. You asked Senator Telfer what we lose by letting the federal government do it, and if we let the federal government do it, what's going to happen again is what happened in my situation, where there was no enforcement because there wasn't someone I could call that could come out right away and deal with it. There wasn't education on a local level to the degree necessary to prevent it from happening in the first place. There needs to be someone that can be called right away when this a violation is happening, and so that not so that the violations are going to get fined all the time, but so the contractors are concerned about violations and therefore get the education necessary so they don't violate the law and they don't poison children. I have a couple of concerns about the HB 2134, and I just wanted to mention those, although I know these are points for the future, but I see this bill as a beginning to solving the problem so other children aren't poisoned as mine were. And I think that in the future we should talk about that limit of the $5,000 being definitely a per incident per day fine, not just a per incident, which is kind of vague, I think. And that eventually, I think, is it a criminal penalty that should be imposed for poisoning children? I think so, and I know that's a little extreme because right now it's set up to be a civil penalty, but I think once this system is in place and contractors are educated, contractors that continue to poison children should be treated as criminals just as they would in any other instance when they poisoned a child, especially something that causes long-term brain damage and impacts a family in this way. I'm also a little concerned about the CCB being involved on this level. I think it's great that the contractor is going to regulate. I'm concerned about them self-regulating to some degree, although I'm happy that they have more manpower than DHS and will give us the resources to catch violators. But I think we have to watch that carefully because they're contractors regulating contractors. It seems a little bit of a fox watching the hen house. And not that they're bad guys, again. It's just about making sure the education's out there. And I think also this bill asks that one person on each job be trained. I think eventually we should move to all workers being trained, even if it's just a short training, bringing that even one step further, where violators of this policy should actually be encouraged to participate in training others to increase their awareness. As a result of our lawsuit, although we didn't settle for enough to cover our costs, our contractor was required to take the training that he said he had taken, and he had to pass the test, and I think that's really important, and it was frustrating to me that his entire crew wasn't required to do that. And just a couple other thoughts. One, that I think this education should start in our elementary schools. I think kids should be involved here because we need to create a generation of adults that are also aware and concerned about this. And someone had asked about funding this program and, concerns, budgetary concerns, and I want you to look at the model of San Diego, which I understand fully funds their program through the fines of violations of lead paint concerns, both homeowners who don't maintain their homes get fined for not doing so, and contractors who use unsafe work practices get fined. And I think that's a great model of a program that's self-funded by the fines, and this could grow into that kind of program. I think that's probably all I can mention right now.
thank you very much. Two sessions ago, I served on the Ways and Means Subcommittee of General Government, and we dealt with the Contractors Board, and I remember long discussions with Craig Smith, who is the director of that board, and how they are really, really, really looking at violations by people who are not really legitimate contractors and by contractors who are not doing what they're supposed to do. And I saw him taking notes when you were speaking, and so I'm sure that he would be anxious to have a conversation with you.
And we've spoken before, and I'm happy for that. And to speak to him additionally, one concern what you just mentioned is this is all about contractors who are licensed and doing the right thing. There's a whole gap here of all the contractors that aren't getting licensed and aren't doing the right thing, and that's why this has to be the beginning of education that goes beyond just our contractor population, because if it starts young and early, then the people who are considering being contractors will be educated and make smart choices in the future so other children aren't poisoned.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Deborah.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank the Chairman Morissette and the committee for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Perry Cabot, and I work for the Community Energy Project in Portland. Every year, I reach over 500 Portland area households with basic lead poisoning prevention workshops in English and in Spanish. I also teach a second workshop educating homeowners and renters on lead-safe work practices during small lead paint disturbing home projects. I'm a State of Oregon certified lead risk assessor. During the course of my work, I receive many calls and questions from concerned citizens with situations and stories that are truly frightening. Each summer, like clockwork, I receive multiple calls each week from people living adjacent to homes being sanded, scraped, or pressure washed to the point of paint and paint dust traveling into neighboring properties. When these calls come in to me, I make an immediate referral to the State of Oregon Department of Human Services lead-based paint program, where there is a single staff person to handle compliance-related issues. When I make the referral, I feel little hope. I feel little hope for an outcome that might result in a contractor or uninformed landlord understanding and accepting responsibility or acting responsibly regarding control of lead-based paint hazards in the course of work. The compliance and enforcement framework, as it exists today, is ill-equipped to effectively and meaningfully protect our communities from the lasting and detrimental effects of lead poisoning. The consequences of the unsafe work practices are weighted almost entirely on children and others who have no choice in the matter. They are the canaries in our lead mine. With nearly half of all lead poisonings in Oregon, as you've been told multiple times, the result of remodeling activities, it's clear that the canary has fallen from the perch, and it's long past time we took action to effectively address this menace to public health. The long-awaited arrival of new EPA rules regarding renovation, repair, and painting demand we confront this issue. Passing House Bill 2134A is an important step in the right direction, as it will grant Oregon local control over certification and enforcement of activities that disturb lead-based paint. With agreement and cooperation between the DHS and CCB already paving the way to rapid and logical division of responsibilities regarding contractor certification and enforcement of worksite violations, passage of this bill will finally clear the way for the State of Oregon to better protect the public from the devastating effects of lead poisoning. On July 31st, 1786, Ben Franklin composed a letter to a friend discussing his observations on the, quote, bad effects of lead taken inwardly. He closes the letter with some words that still resonate today. "You will see by it that the opinion of this mischievous effort from lead is at least above 60 years old, and you will observe with concern how long a useful truth may be known and exist before it is generally received and practiced on. We know the truth as it exists about lead hazards. We're here today to deliver the message that the state can best protect its own communities from this hazard. And we hope that you receive and practice on this message by passing House Bill 2134A. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I say one little follow-up based on what you said? Which is that both of us, I think, said that this is a beginning and a step, and it's a really important beginning, and we support it as a beginning. And there's going to be a lot of work to refine it, I think, and make sure that all of the pieces come together. And I'm willing to help, and I know Perry is within his job capacity, but it needs to start somewhere.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. We have Scott Barry, and if John Chandler would please come up here and sit next to him, I would really appreciate it. One of the things, while I'm waiting for John to approach the bench, and I'm going to put him under oath here in a minute. When I was a child, I used to make lead soldiers. My father worked in a foundry in Anaconda, Montana, and he would also bring home mercury in a little jar, and I would rub mercury on dimes, and I'd take it to school, and we'd roll the little mercury balls around, and we would make lead soldiers. And today there's lead weights for fishing, and there's lead in the buckshot that people use to kill small animals and eat them. So
I don't know if that goes up the food chain, but we got a lot of lead around, right?
Mr. Chair, the lead weights for fishing, I had a case. We were trying to figure out, working with Multnomah County, why this child got lead poisoning. It was because his dad had all these lead weights, and the child would play for them and suck on them.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how that
So you guys out. Should come up with a bumper sticker that says, get the lead out, right? John, would you write that down?
Good morning. Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders in support of House Bill 2134A. And we spent a lot of time working with the DHS and with the Construction Contractors Board on refining this program. It is a mandate from the EPA. So in terms of getting education for contractors, that was coming down in April 2010 for all of us. This was more for us about how do we make this work for contractors, get the education to them, in fact, get what we thought was better enforcement through the Contractors Board with a number of enforcement people already out in the field checking licenses and doing other enforcement projects. The other key for us, and I think a big point in our support of this bill, is how do we get that message out to the homeowner? Because I think the vast majority of these cases involve the homeowner who has no idea that when they sand that window inside their house to repaint the interior of a house they just bought that may be built before 1978 or certainly before 1948 where basically every house in, has lead-based paint in it. How do we get that message out to those folks that they can't just walk out and get the belt sander out and start sanding down their window seals and then go sit down for a dinner and go back to working on their house later on? That's going to be a big effort. I think, again, as some of the previous folks mentioned, something we really need to focus on. To that end, we did actually work with the Contractors Board and DHS in mandating that in this bill, if it were to pass, that the civil penalty money go towards public education of lead-based paint. So that's not for contractors who will be mandated to get this education and will, from this point forward, have that education. But that money would be spent by those two agencies, again, their civil penalty money, to educate the consumer through trade shows, through all sorts of public access, where they would spread that word, so to speak, to get that word out that you can't just start remodeling your own house without understanding that some of the dangers, especially in these older houses. So I just wanted to comment on that. Again, support for 2134, which we spent quite a bit of time on the House side refining.
Mr. Chair, I think most contractors, licensed contractors, do follow the law. I just feel it's so tragic that Tamara had to go through what she had to go through. And I think it's really important, though, for contractors to be held accountable. And in the remodeling that I have a 1959 house, they put draped all of the plastic and when they remodeled my kitchen and then remodeled my bathroom. So they obviously were paying close attention to it. But there are a lot of contractors out there that aren't licensed. I think they're practicing under the table, so to speak, just because they're trying to make a buck and they're saving money by not being licensed. And so there's a lot of education, I think, to the public in that aspect too, to make sure that when you're having major remodeling that you need to have someone who is really qualified, although in Tamara's case they said they were qualified and then they weren't, but that's the nature of the game.
Thank you. Other comments? John, do you have anything to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, also for the Oregon Homeowners Association, in support of this bill. I just want to mention on the education front a couple of things that the agencies are already aware of, but we are starting to gear up to provide the education to our members. I have a conference call actually later this morning with a company we're contracting with to do online education for continuing education for contractors generally, but we're going to have them help us develop specifically the lead-based paint curriculum so we can go live with that. I have another conference call tomorrow with our national association where we're going to be be working in concert with them. It's our intention, once we get the curriculum established in Oregon, to get EPA certification for it as well. And to the issue of unlicensed contractors, while it's not within the scope of this bill, it is certainly our, every session we talk to you folks about the, increasing the CCB's ability, giving them the budget they need, to do that enforcement. It makes my heart to hear the stories about the damage that, that untrained, unlicensed, unskilled contractors do. We do not support that. We never have. As an industry, it is in our interest, the good contractor's interest, to make sure that the bad ones are out and fined, penalized, horsewhipped, and otherwise abused. We stand behind that constantly. We hope that this, not this is the Ways and Means Committee or anything, but as budgets move forward, we hope that you'll keep in mind that some agencies do need to make sure they're kept whole so that they can do the work, the very important work that's necessary, particularly the feeder of an agency. Yes, sir.
Thank you, John. A homeowner could ask a contractor if they are certified to do the lead paint. Is there a certification that is available that they could, the contractor? I mean, there are many parts of the contractor's training and contract, and so I wonder if it's broken down into that. One other thing, we had a large tree removed because it was digging up our house, and the guy that we hired said he was bonded. And when he came, showed up, my wife asked him to prove it, and he couldn't. So he had to leave and come back with the papers. And so I would not have thought of doing that, but she did. So, I mean, I think, and I, you know, so it's up to the homeowner also to ask for the certification. And I'm wondering if they're, can you answer that, or do we need
Senator Morris, I think I can answer that. Today there is a lead abatement training program.
Okay.
Prior to this EPA mandate, lead abatement program that's been in place, and those folks are licensed for that activity. Moving forward, before you renew your license with the contractors board, you'll have to demonstrate, if you're doing these remodeling projects, that you have that that new education on lead-based paint before you receive your license. That'll be a requirement before you.
Well, how does that translate into the homeowner saying, show me, prove to me that you are fully qualified?
And my understanding is Chair Morissette and Craig Smith or Gail Shibley can maybe
answer. Okay, because I think that's something that...
My understanding is, today, if you're licensed and bonded and insured, the consumer is able to go on the contractor's website, plug in the CCB number, and make sure that those folks are licensed, insured, and bonded.
Okay, Craig, did you want to add?
Mr. Chair, I just informed by Director Shipley that the new regulations, which are I would not want to take a quiz on, so I'm glad you told me this, will require that the certificate be available on the job site. So once the contractor takes the training, passes the test, does all the things we're required to do, they have to have a piece of paper that they have to have.
Okay,
steps.
Good. Craig, did you want to add to that? That's what I'm getting at, because it would be very helpful if they had to bring that with them when they were doing the job and the homeowner was aware of that.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, Craig Smith, that's one of the values added, I think, of having CCB involved in the process, is that we're going to keep those records. Those records are going to be available on the website. They are refreshed twice a day, so if a contractor loses their certification or doesn't have that certification, that's the place a consumer can go, find out if they're licensed, find out if their bond is there, find out if their insurance is there, and of course, if either of those two financial protections aren't available, their license is made inactive. And if, in fact, they haven't had this training, it'll show that as well.
Okay, but what if you don't have a computer? What if somebody, the contractor shows up at the door, and if a homeowner says, well, I want you to show me that you are certified and such, do they have a piece of paper with them?
Chair Morissette, the license that we issue eventually will have an indication as to whether or not they have that kind of certification. But today, that's again, I think one of the value added at the CCB is that we have five people answering the phone. We answer about 500 such inquiries a day from consumers and others who want to know, what kind of a license does my contractor have? And, of course, as I've said to you before, that's a big advantage. When you call the CCB, you don't get a computer. You get a person that answers the phone and has the ability to look that information up on the computer.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I guess that's the end of our testimony. So we will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2134 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves by prior reference a referral to Ways and Means with a subsequent referral to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With a subsequent, well, I'm trying to do it backwards. I'm trying to do it in the reverse order.
Got all the words in there.
Got all the words in there, absolutely.
With a due pass recommendation. And which bill are we talking about? Senate Bill 2134. Okay. discussion. Okay. Concerns? Seen? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Moss, absent.
Aye.
Senator Harris.
Aye.
Senator
Shelton. Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morris.
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 2134 is on its way to Ways and Means. Where are we?
We have 2068 and 2123 to
hear. Okay. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on 2868. House Bill 2868.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2868A engrossed requires the Department of Human Services to provide on a quarterly basis and at minimal cost orientation for new child care providers who are not registered or certified but are approved to receive funds from the Department for Child Care Services. It requires the orientation to cover financial and food resources, reimbursements, and provider rights and responsibility. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued.
There was a fiscal statement.
Fiscal statement was issued, but there's no fiscal impact. They'll use existing staff.
Okay. Do we have a list of... Megan, were you going to testify? Yes. Would you come up, please? Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry we've taken so long to get here. Hopefully we can wrap this up in 7 minutes.
Hello, Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Naomi Masters. I am a child care provider here in Salem, and I am here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2868, the mandatory orientation bill.
Okay.
I've been a child care provider for the last 10 years, but I've been privileged to work with the ERDC program in the state of Oregon for the last five. I've cared for seven children from five different families, and when I first started, the only thing I knew was about 3 weeks after I started taking kids, I got the billing form in the mail. I had no idea how to go through the billing form. I had no idea if I was doing it right. And for the first 3.5 years that I did childcare, I made quite a few costly mistakes. When you make a mistake on your billing form, your pay is delayed. And with our pay being as low as it is, any mistake that delays your payment can become a huge cost really fast. After I took the orientation, it was about 1.5 years ago, I have had no problems whatsoever with my billing forms. I've always gotten my pay on time. When I first signed up for it, the only thing I knew is that I could go in and ask questions. I didn't know that I was going to be led to the vital resources that I was. I went in with the intentions of asking a few questions on how I could not make the same mistakes I had been making before. And what I found was that not only did they take us through a detailed example of how to fill out our billing form correctly, but they also gave us... they also taught us about resources like the enhanced rate training. We can go through and get CPR and first aid. We have a program that teaches us about child abuse and neglect prevention. And they also give us vital skills for proper food preparation and cleanliness so that we can avoid the children that we're taking care of getting any kind of illness from poor food preparation. While I was at the orientation, I met and heard other providers that had similar problems that I had had with filling out the billing forms. And with some of them, it turned into an utter nightmare, the problems that they had with their billing forms. I am happy to say that once we left the orientation, The people that were in my classroom, we have all met back up, and we have all discussed the fact that just going to the one orientation has made us not only better at filling out our billing forms, but it's also made us more adept in our job because it led us to the training. I love the child care program, the ERDC program. I think it is amazing that low-income families can get the quality of care that is given by the ERDC program. And if I could point out, the one thing that's missing would be mandatory orientations. If we can make the orientations mandatory, then 100% of the child care providers that are providing care would go through the same orientation, and they would be given the same skills that we were given.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sylvia Farr, and I'm a child care provider. I provide a child care through the ERDC program, and I've been providing care since the year 2000. I currently provide care for two children at this time through the ERDC program. I support the mandatory orientation for license-exempt child care providers because these orientations provide us with information that we need to fill out our paperwork correctly, right? As well as the timeline for how long we're supposed to keep records of our paperwork. This information is important because it can prevent billing errors, just like Naomi said. When I attend an orientation, I also learned about opportunities that help me improve as a provider, such as the Enhanced Rate Training Program. I attended this training program after signing up for orientation. Now I'm certified in CPR and first aid, and I also have my food handler's card, and I can recognize child abuse and neglect. I also learned how to who to contact if I had questions about the billing forms and the hours that I'm eligible to be paid for. Before attending orientation, I was confused about the billing forms and how to calculate what amount to charge for payment according to the zip codes because they pay you differently according to the zip code that you provide care in. And in conclusion, the orientation helps us as child care providers become more aware of our responsibilities and requirements. The training we sign up for at orientation helps us to be more confident in handling emergencies and keeping the children safe. The orientations train us how to fill out forms correctly, which cuts down on unnecessary paperwork for the state. Mandatory orientations would help make sure all exempt child care providers have access to important information and opportunities that orientations provide. Right now, many providers don't know about the orientations, but making them mandatory would eliminate many of the problems for other providers that I encountered before attending orientation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I represent the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent approximately 5,000 license-exempt child care providers who provide care through either the Employment-Related Daycare Program or the TANF Jobs Program. These providers are, because they're license-exempt, they do not have an orientation that is mandatory. We, through work with the resource and referral agencies and through collective bargaining, created a optional orientation, which over 700 people as of 2 months ago have participated in, and we have two people here who saw the great benefit of it. This making this mandatory, I think, is an important loop for not only for the process of the program, and we did have a case that we worked with a member who had not understood the billing process for a significant period of time. And what happens is the department does random audits, and they randomly audited her, and she had not kept appropriate records like she was supposed to for several years back, ending up in and I don't want to get the number wrong, but several thousand dollars of overbilling. She had overbilled for several thousands of dollars to the state. She was not capable of paying that back. We worked closely with the state to mitigate the circumstance and do what, you know, what she was really capable of doing, and appreciated the state's flexibility on that. But that was an overbillment at state cost of several thousand dollars. This is not an anomaly. It is a very complicated billing system. Just to explain how our providers are paid, they are the 88th percentile, the 88th percent of the 75th percentile of the market rate study via zip code. So if you ask me how much does a child care provider make, I would have to ask you, how old is the child? How many hours is the child taken care of? What zip code does the child live in? Has the child care provider done the enhanced rate? It's not an easy question. And without an orientation to explain all the different things that go into somebody needing to correctly fill out their form, it can be very confusing. I would also really want to thank the Department of Human Services, Vic Todd and his staff, along with Mark Anderson from the Network of Resource and Referral Agencies, who worked very hard on this bill to make it so that it is fiscally neutral and can be absorbed into current funds. That's greatly appreciated. A lot of that is going to be in what are currently small class sizes, increasing a little bit, but I wanted to give my thanks to the department being such a great partner in this, and something I think will greatly enhance quality for the children.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Vic, did you have something that we're going to have to leave here in just a moment? So, thank you very much for being here and waiting.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, administrator for the Children's or for Office of Self-Sufficiency within Children's and Adults and Families Division of the Department of Human Services, and I'll just say that we support this change, and there is no fiscal impact resulting from it.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Do they have to pay a fee to take the orientation?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, no.
Okay. Thank you, Vic.
Thank you.
Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2868A.
And, Mr. Chair, we have the A2s. Is that, no one spoke to the A2s.
Oh, do we have an amendment?
I don't know.
Mr. Neely, I have the A2s. Is this an amendment that anyone else has?
No. That's dealing with, excuse me for, I believe that, isn't that 2123? The A2s are on House Bill 2123.
Okay, I just have the wrong bill, the wrong amendment to the wrong bill.
Okay.
Thank you. This is what, 2868?
Yeah. Okay. Do I have a motion on?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2868 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson moves House Bill 2868A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Senator
Montes
Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
Excused.
Vice
Excused.
Chair
aye. House Bill 2868A passes. Going to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And before we do the final gavel, we just voted on this.
Okay.
Would you like to vote on House Bill 2868A?
Okay. I will not change the outcome.
No, that will not change the outcome. Okay. So Senator Cruz votes aye on House Bill 2868A. And our session is closed, and we are adjourned.
Well, who's going to carry the bill?
I will carry the bill. I was going to have Senator Cruz carry it.
But I showed up.